On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Kim Wright Velich, your moderator this evening. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guests. Michael Lombardo has served as CEO of Reading Partners since 2006. He previously held a number of positions at the University of California at Berkeley, including Director of Development, College Relations in the College of Letters and Sciences, and Director of Scholarships at the Alumni Association. Michael is also a social entrepreneur in residence at Stanford University. Erin Ganju is co-founder and CEO of Room to Read. She was selected as one of the World Economic Forum's Schwab Foundation Social Entrepreneurs in 2014 and one of Fast Company's Extraordinary Women of 2012. Erin is a member of the Young Presidents Organization, Forbes Executive Women's Board, and Global Social Venture Competition Advisory Board. Kate James joined Pearson as Chief Corporate Affairs Officer in January 2014. She was previously Chief Communications Officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, focused on raising awareness and building engagement around global poverty, health, and U.S. education issues. Kate also sits on the board of Vital Voices and is dedicated to empowering women in business, civil society, and politics. Welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining us. Why don't we jump right in? And I want to start with understanding what literacy means. It seems that if you could read, that would be an efficient definition of literacy. But I understand it's much more complicated than that. So I'm actually going to start with Michael, but all of you could, if you could pipe in on the definition of literacy.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here today. I think the definition of literacy has evolved considerably in the last generation. And as we think about both the mechanics of literacy, which is the ability of children and adults to decode texts and to make sounds from them, we've evolved now into the higher level comprehension type of thinking. And I think as the advanced economies of the world migrate from more of an industrial base to more of a service base, it's those higher level comprehension functions that are becoming more and more critical and that have been the backbone of what we use as the kind of primary foundational assessment here in the United States called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP. And NAEP comes under fire a lot because it sets a very high bar in comprehension. That's been reinforced recently domestically through the movement towards the Common Core State Standards, where we're really looking for students not simply to be able to read words off the page, but to internalize, to organize the information they've gotten from texts, and then to be able to apply that in critical problem-solving situations. So I think the headline is the bar for literacy has gone up, and I think that as the more advanced economies continue to become more knowledge-based, it will continue to go up in the future.
Erin, do you want to touch on it in the global context?
Yeah, I think Michael's done a great job, and obviously the wonderful opportunity of this panel. It's great to be here with you tonight, to have a domestic and a global focus. And I think in the global sense, agree with everything what Michael's saying, is the way that Room to Read has sort of defined it is to be independent readers by both having the skills and the regular habit of reading. So exactly, you know, as we're saying, the skills are so critical and often, you know, challenging in government school systems that we work in to ensure are there, but that's not enough. You also want to have a regular habit of reading so that you're interacting and learning and you know, growing. And in many cases, we're working in cultures that are very oral-based cultures, so creating that culture of reading is actually very important, so that the skills are not just decoding or being able to, you know, read a few words functionally, but actually to be able to use them to be lifelong learners and be, you know, productive in your life.
Kate, do you want to touch on sort of the definition of literacy in terms of expanding to cultural literacy or technology or?
I think the other two have given an incredibly comprehensive definition. I think the way that we think about it is that it's, you know, it's the fundamental building block of education. and when you're looking at how do students realize their potential. So I think absolutely in a lot of the markets that probably we're looking at from a global perspective, then it really is about enabling students to be able to read and have that level of confidence. But I think increasingly as we look at, you know, particularly here in North America and other developed markets, I think it starts taking on a much wider definition. And as we think about 21st century skills, then, you know, coding is probably as fundamental to people to be able to realize their potential as the ability to read is currently.
Mm-hmm. The UN established in 2000 millennial goals, and to be achieved by 2015, which were, you know, there. And the education goal was to achieve universal primary education. And there has been an increase in most of Africa and a great deal in South Asia of about 10 or 15% increase in access. So the question is, what's the problem? You want to jump in, Erin?
Well, I think we have done a better job, and I think it is important to celebrate when there are initiatives like the Millennium Development Goals where you can garner support and focus on an issue, that, you know, there has been progress. Most of the out-of-school children now are oftentimes in situations where they are internally displaced people. They are, you know, potentially don't have a stable political situation to be able to access a school. So, you know, I think there's been great improvement in getting children into school, butts in seats, as they say. The challenge is really a quality issue. You still have, you know, 250 million children that show up right now somewhere in the world. That's 40% of the primary age going population of school age children, primary school age children, who cannot read, write, or have basic numeracy skills. So it's a failure. It's the fact that they actually are going to a school and they're making their best efforts, but they are not. We're not having a basic, you know, skill building at those primary ages. And then kids start to drop out of school. It's not relevant to them, and it's not going to help them, you know, help them and their families with the basic necessities in life. And so it's a quality issue that we're dealing with now, even more than an access issue.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the Millennium Development Goals were phenomenal and in many ways achieved a huge amount. But I think one of the big challenges, particularly around the education goal, was that it was very focused on inputs. And the big shift, which hopefully the, you know, the success of the Millennium Development Goals, the Sustainable Development Goals will address, is exactly to Erin's point that we need to be focused much more on outcomes and to that point to equality, rather than thinking success can just be measured on inputs. And I think that's one of the concerns around the MDGs.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking as I was preparing tonight about Pratham in India, and as the panelists know, Pratham, through volunteers, much like Michael's organization, does assessment of literacy in India, and it has become sort of the reporters wait for the report to come out to see how, and it holds the government accountable. So I thought we should probably, because if the millennial goals were part of their challenge was they weren't focused on outputs, we ought to talk about assessment in both in the domestic context and in the global context. Do you want to touch on that, Michael?
Yeah, I think we're at a pivotal moment in the United States, and the question is whether we will lead on assessment and be continue down the pathway of having rigorous requirements that look not just at students' proficiency, but that require states to break them down by subgroup of different ethnicities, linguistic backgrounds, students' income levels, and that hold schools and school districts accountable for achievement across those groups. As you probably know, there's a bill pending in Congress now that would roll that back significantly and would really return us to the late 90s era of, we think of as the Wild West, or I've heard it called Choose Your Own Adventure, in which states domestically can set their own assessment regime, have very little accountability, and are no longer creating what has been, I think, a really generational shift in the U.S. system where we have a tremendously data-rich environment. So it's an exciting moment where I think, I hope, we're going to reaffirm our commitment to being an assessment-based nation and to recognize that for teachers to be great teachers, for schools to be held accountable for achievement, that we have to operate in a data-rich environment. And I think it also creates an opportunity for us to lead globally as we think about our learnings from what these data are telling us. And I think American school children are probably the most studied school children in the world, and that's not by accident. And I think we can continue to be an exporter of knowledge about instructional strategies, technology, and approaches that work for students, but not if we take a step backward and scale back No Child Left Behind.
Aaron, you want to touch on it in the global context? It's a very different environment.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge in the global context, at least in the countries that are, you know, sort of some of the most challenged developing countries that really have a difficult time investing in education and finding ways to use assessment to not be a penalty, but to be a motivator for greater investment, greater focus. You know, you don't want to create assessment tools that become, you know, a hammer on a school or on teachers that, you know, and really backfires on the goal. The goal is to find ways to use assessment and tools and metrics to ensure that it's, you know, motivating more focus on the primary goal of children learning and having, you know, increasing outcomes. For us, you know, most of the languages that we're working in, there actually are not standards. So, you know, what is appropriate for a grade one student to be reading how many words per minute by the end of grade one? I mean, most of the countries we're working in cannot define that in their local language. So we actually are working at levels trying to, there's an early grade reading assessment tool that we use, that many organizations use, that's been tested in over 90 languages. We added some comprehension questions to the point Michael's making on comprehension. But, you know, we're at a baseline working with governments to say, let's even start this idea of developing standards so we know what we're aiming for so that we can then continually assess and build the data over time that will allow us to know what are high performing schools or high performing classrooms or, you know, however you want to use it. But it's at a very beginning level.
And Pearson is a bit of an expert on testing and assessment, and you fund organizations, so you're probably looking at them all the time about whether they're delivering. So what is your theory on this?
I mean, I think actually what I was going to say is that it's as important, less about perhaps how we look at some of our partners, but more to the point of how do we hold ourselves accountable? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we made a commitment a couple of years ago that we will report from 2018, not just on our financial returns, which is obviously super important from our shareholder base perspective, but for our learners and all our other partners, we'll report on our outcomes. So to Aaron's point on quality, I think the private sector has as important responsibility and accountability here to be able to show that our products and services really are having meaningful impact. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, early days, but now when we're looking at new investments, anything that's over £1 million, we're going to make sure that it also can show real proven outcomes, which is, you know, it's a big lift for the organization. But I think, you know, back to the quality point, it's up to everyone has got mm-hmm. to deliver their part on this.
I want to keep down this path a little bit because I think these are pretty challenging things to assess outcomes, and you probably do it internally. So if you guys could share how you do your own assessment of impact and not just outputs, but outcomes, I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think any good assessment regime begins with a clear understanding of what you're trying to accomplish for students. And in our case, we're driving towards every child being able to read proficiently by the end of fourth grade, which captures both those decoding and comprehension skills. We're able to, because of the data-rich environment that is in American public schools today, be able to both access school-level assessment data and then also to assess students ourselves on a pre- and post-basis and to look at how they performed over the course of the school year towards benchmarks that we set that are achievable for students, but that move them towards proficiency.
You know, I should interrupt you
sure.
here because we haven't really explained how Reading Partners works.
So
if you would first explain how Reading Partners works, then I think the context of assessment will make more sense.
Yeah, so we're a national nonprofit based here in the Bay Area that's working to close the early reading achievement gap for children by unleashing the human capital potential of volunteer service to provide targeted one-on-one instruction for students struggling with reading. We partner with about 70 school systems across 9 states in the United States and work directly at the school level. We place trained volunteers using a highly structured, research-validated curriculum to work one-on-one with students. So that assessment component is critical for us. We're working with students who are between 6 months and 3 years below where they should be in their reading. And so we first have to understand where they are, what their needs are. And when you're working in a remediation context, an intervention context, you need students to not simply continue on the pace of reading achievement they have. They have to double, triple, or even quadruple it to catch up with their peers. And so that assessment component is critical to us, both to know where they are and then to monitor their progress. We can adapt our strategy to make sure they're successful. One of the other things that's essential, and I think this is maybe more of a problem in the United States, less globally, is we're a fairly robust sector, and we talked about this before, of reading organizations that are out there in public schools, and understanding what unique impact your organization or that strategy is driving is critical. And really the gold standard for that kind of evaluation is randomized control trials, which we recently published just last week, a three-state randomized control trial across California, New York, and Washington, D.C., where we were able to look at students in a control group who were demographically identical to reading partner students, compare them to reading partner students, and see that reading partner students on average gain 2 months more of reading over the course of the school year than their peers. And that's an incredibly exciting thing to see.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, do you want to touch on what exactly Room to Read does and then how you assess it?
Sure. So Room to Read is a global nonprofit organization focused on ensuring that every child has high quality learning opportunities in their local community. And we do that in two key ways. One is our early grade literacy program focused on working with government schools. We work in 10 countries across Asia and Africa to ensure that they have better tools and ability to deliver high quality literacy. We do that really through, I think, two key ways. One is focusing on the curriculum in grades 1 and 2 and supporting teachers in particular and boosting their professional development for teaching kids to learn to read and write. And the second is on flooding the zone with this great tool that many of you might have heard of called a school library, which is all about creating wonderful opportunities for kids to practice reading and engage in reading through access of materials that they don't have anywhere else in their communities. You know, majority of the kids that we work with come from homes that both the mother and the father are likely illiterate. So that's sort of our key literacy work. And our second program is our girls' education program. You know, the other key issue in the countries that we work in is that girls drop out of school towards the end of primary school, and they don't continue on. Only 1 out of every 5 girls, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa will make it to secondary school. And so we're focused on keeping girls in school longer and providing them a key life skills curriculum so that they can navigate the difficult decisions that girls have. So the two key ways that we look at measuring that is, first, when we talk about outcomes, we are talking about things like words per minute and how do we measure fluency and find metrics to focus on learning outcomes. In our girls program, we're talking about are girls advancing to the next grade? Are they transitioning? Are they finishing secondary school? But even after that, what do they transition to? We know how many girls in our program have gone on to university or vocational programs, et cetera. The metrics around monitoring, though, I think are almost as important. So Room to Read's working in over 17,000 communities now over the course of our 15-year history in these 10 countries. And so what we're also trying to do is how do we focus our resources to be most effective as an intervention point? We work in with our literacy program for 4 years. And what do we need to be working with the schools to really institutionalize our literacy program so that when our formal funding ends, these are government schools, we want them to be able to, sustain the program without Room to Read. What do we need to be doing? And for example, in our school library program, we have a 15 indicator that we look at from, how many books are being checked out, how many literacy activities are happening in libraries, how many hours are the library open, do they have a library committee, all sorts of different ways that we know equal a great school library, a well-functioning library. And so over the course of our time working, we are really working to ensure that the school understands, all these key components, and we're training and building their capacity.
Mm-hmm. Kate, why don't you tell us about Project Literacy and what Pearson's doing with that project?
For us, whilst we already have a number of products that are directly directed towards literacy, this is a new initiative for us. And we made a call last year that whereas we thought about our CSR activities very much at arm's length, if you like, through the through the foundation, literacy for us was an immediate area to turn to, back to this whole sort of thinking around it being a real fundamental building block of education. And so we're thinking about literacy really in terms of three buckets. Mm-hmm. Firstly, to this approach of integrating all our CSR activity actually into our core business model. So how do we use our products, our services, our intellectual capital, our people, really importantly, our innovation and our research, to look at ways to really help sort of support partners and to tackle the literacy challenge. Secondly, we're looking at how do we use our voice and in terms of community advocacy, working with new partners, and these guys are working with us with GOOD here in California about how do we build real awareness and understanding and create opportunities for people to get engaged on literacy. And then thirdly is really thinking about smart partners. And I, you know, for us, I think it's really important, though, we launched this at the end of last year. We're really in listening mode on this. We've committed that this is our big flagship initiative, that we're in it for the next 5 years minimum. Mm-hmm. But we want to make sure that when we go in and we're in a space where there's a load of really good work already going on, where can we make the biggest difference? Where can we act to either to help scale or to act as a real catalyst? So a lot of the work that we're doing at the moment is very much a listening exercise, and we've been out there through hashtag Project Literacy asking people to share what their experiences are, what are the potential barriers and challenges, so that when our interventions really have genuine impact.
Mm-hmm. So since you brought up scale, Michael, I'll turn to you. I know that Reading Partners grew from 3 volunteers in one school in 1999 to, I believe, 160 schools today. So why don't you talk to us about scaling, the challenges of scaling, and why it's important. And then Aaron, I'm prepping you. I'm going to turn to you and ask you to talk about Room to Read scale, because I understand you've been identified by the Brookings Institute to be studied for the Millions Learning Project around how you scale. So I'll start with you, Michael.
Yeah, I think one of the maddening aspects of the public education system in the United States is that we by and large know what works. And as I said, we've had decades of research on different strategies for school children that are adapted into the specific environment of our public schools here, and we know what works. And I think at Reading Partners, where we are a proven solution that we know works, the question is, how do you get schools to do more of it? And how do you get policymakers at the state and at the federal level to shift away from strategies we know don't work towards strategies that do? And I think one of the critical levers there is really thinking about the resource equation for your work. And so what does it take to make Reading Partners happen or Room to Read happen in a school building? And one aspect of our MDRC evaluation I mentioned earlier that's exciting is we looked at cost equations across 3 states, and we said, what are the different supports that are there for students? What are the resource avenues that are coming into those buildings? And we could say that bringing community service and volunteerism, this seems intuitive, but bringing volunteerism into schools was a resource multiplier and was able to leverage pre-existing dollars that schools were already spending, the buildings they already had, the materials and books they already had in the school library in a really powerful way, in a 5x multiplier for every dollar schools put in. And so So I think it's just critical that everyone has, as you begin to find strategies that they're working, you think about what would it take to do this, not at, 10 schools, but at 100 schools and then at 1,000 schools, and create that sort of a resource map that leverages what's already out there. And in some cases also involves advocacy and awareness to increase what's out there. And I think that if you come at it from both directions, you can create an environment where if your organization isn't doing the work, another organization that looks somewhat like you will, and that gets you out of the business of saying, I have to be in all 50 states or I have to be in every country in the world, but instead you create a kind of a resource economy that's going to drive all kinds of players and organizations to learn from your research, look at what you've proven works, and then begin to implement that at true scale.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, before you jump to answer the question I gave you a warning about, I'm going to add an element to it, which is how do you maintain quality?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot harder question than how did we scale, but a fair question on both of them. So we are really excited to have been selected. There's 15 organizations at Brookings Institute. They have a Center for Universal Education, and they've chosen 15 organizations to look more deeply at how they've scaled. And I think, they're in the middle of their research and doing a lot of great, interviews, kind of understanding how it works. So I will give you the headlines, having been there as one of the co-founders, what I think and I hope that they will come back to, but it will be great to see from their own research what they think the levers were. But I think key to our model, is that, one, we are working within a system called the government school system, right? So mm-hmm. it does reach the most underserved communities, and it is a highly scalable
system. It is, you know, sort of the good and the bad of a lot of what we do, in the sense that it's challenging and can be bureaucratic and, you know, many things. It's not, you know, government school systems are not necessarily known for being the most innovative, cutting edge, you know, systems. However, you do reach children, and you reach them in their communities. And when you can prove that a model works, and we do have the evidence, you know, data now, we have, you know, cross-national evaluations done on our library program by, you know, outside evaluators that show that it improves children reading more both in school and at home, you know, with room to reads intervention, you know, at their school compared to control schools, right? So we have evidence. We're able to then really change the minds of the government, and you're actually able to scale much faster. So I think that's a key part of it. It's also, I think, how Room to Read has structured ourselves. We have strong local nationals in each of our countries that are Room to Read full-time staff, but they're deeply ingrained in the education system and the language and the understanding how to engage the communities to create this change. So we have a model that's very, you know, if you will, takes the best of international best practices and know-how in education and has a deeply contextualized component to it in the countries that we work in. And so I think how we've been able to grow, and this is, you know, answering your point of quality, how we've been able to grow and scale to reach 17,000 communities with high quality results is because we have been able to take these great practices, best practices, but we've been able to ensure that we are contextualizing them and making sure that they're appropriate for the communities that we're in. It's not a cookie cutter model. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think you do, you know, meet communities and you meet school systems and teachers and parents where they're at, and you're able to bring them, you know, through a system that we have kind of now over time refined. You know, it's almost a checklist system, right? It uses the tools that we know have worked and proven, and you can go out and you can do it over and over again.
How do you do that and be context specific? Well, because the issues in one region, yeah, of, in, you know, northern Nigeria are different than those in southern Nigeria, for example, right? And the issues in Nigeria are different than those in Afghanistan. Of course, you're not in Afghanistan, but...
Nor Nigeria, but...
No, right. But that was a really good example, wasn't it?
It's Zambia and Laos, for example.
Okay.
No, it's a great, you know, it's a great point. I mean, I think what we have seen, and this is actually part of one of the things that I love about Room to Read the most, is that we're a really learning organization. So we start out with entrepreneurial roots to really test and try things. And, you know, and failure, you can learn a lot from failure, right? Speaking of technology, we were talking earlier, we had a technology program and a computer lab program that was a massive, you know, unsuccessful program. It was expensive. It didn't have great results. It was hard to do. And so we really went back to a lot of the, you know, tried and true sort of books and teachers and what works in the context that we're working in. But I think that the question in terms of how do we know it's working and, you know, what are we looking at is we're really, really focused on ensuring that we're taking best practices. And there are many, many things about schools that are similar. So I think you have to sort of understand that the general environment, I mean, there's teacher absentee, you know, challenges, there's low investment in education, there's curriculum, you know, complex curriculum issues that only get revised every 5 or so years on a national scale. And there's, you know, distribution, you know, challenge. I mean, so many of the things that we face are very similar. So there is probably, you know, I don't know what exactly percentage, maybe 50-60% of things are pretty similar from community to community, from country to country. And if we can design around those things that we know are challenges, very typical challenges, and then when we take our, you know, core sort of curriculum that we have, we can then spend our time with our country teams, working with teachers, engaging them in the process, working with the government education sector, engaging them in the process to refine those best practices to apply to their country, their context, their community.
So one of the things that is a little bit context specific, in the U.S., when you think about gender issues, you think about girls in STEM and you think about the glass ceilings. But today, there are more girls in college than there are boys. Mm-hmm. So we have slightly different issues here than in the global context. In the global context, what are the issues facing girls and why focus on them? Because my understanding now is that at the primary level, they've almost achieved gender parity in most places of the world. Now, you touched on a little bit when you talked about the transition from primary to secondary. Do you want to touch on that?
Well, I think, you know, key to this is I think broadly, one of the things that the world, and I'm very heartened by this, is starting to recognize is that the issue of girls and women in the developing world is a challenge. If you, for example, read Half the Sky by Christoph and Cheryl Wodunn, you know, essentially one of the things they say is last century, you know, the issue was around slavery. This issue, it's around how women and girls are treated. And so the focus, one of the best areas that you can invest in, whether it be public health care, education, you know, many different initiatives, is really on investing in how do you help women and girls succeed. The story with girls in school is that they are generally achieving attendance in primary school. The issue, though, is parity and attendance does not equal parity in performance. So there's a lot of biases once girls are in classrooms I think we have to be aware of, even in girls attending school more. And they drop out in far faster rates by the time they're transferring to secondary school. So the issue is more that they are, you know, receiving basic education, but they're not going further on. And so they are definitely limiting in terms of their life choices. And there are not many investors or focus, you know, enough on this issue. I mean, it's 50% of our population globally. Thankfully, Kidna Giving, who Kim is the president of, is one at the forefront of leading initiative of what is working in terms of ensuring girls have equal opportunity and are focused on not just to get them in school, but to keep them there and to focus on being empowered to make their own life choices. What women and girls need is to feel the confidence, the self-awareness, the have the skills, obviously, too, and the opportunity to make their own choices.
And Kate, I know that this issue has been one that's sort of been near and dear to you. Do you want to add a perspective on women and girls in education?
No, I mean, I think Erin summed it up really, really nicely. I mean, I think the, you know, the key thing is that it's not enough to set the bar at primary school. That it's really important to look what's happening once, you know, particularly when girls get to puberty and you start seeing all sorts of issues that prevent them continuing in education and leading them to drop out. And I think that, you know, the important thing is that you have to look at this issue holistically, you know, because there are so many other sort of, you know, cultural, socioeconomic issues that are coming into play that need to be addressed. You know, so it, yes, absolutely, you need to look at education and you need to look at literacy, and that gets very quickly into a virtuous circle, which is fantastic. But then you're also looking, you know, aside at issues from things like, you know, girls getting married far too young, and you know, you see immediately as soon as girls have, you know, kids at a much earlier age, then that again has massive impact for the next generation. So you know, it's an incredibly complex challenge. And that, as you say, rightly so, there isn't still, I don't think, enough focus. And yet, you know, particularly looking at it from a private sector perspective, there is huge commercial opportunity because, as you say, it's 50% of the population. And Ngozi, you know, comments always said, when you know, think of the three big markets that are coming, it's China, it's India, and it's women, you know, and right. And we miss a massive trick at our peril if we don't focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Which... there's something you just said that made me think about cross-sector partnerships. Maybe it's because you were talking about the private sector. So do you want to touch on how you see the three sectors, the private sector? You know, clearly most education is delivered by government. And then we have the social sector, either NGOs or domestically nonprofits, and how you see them working together to make something happen.
Well, I think you've said it. The key thing is that they are working together. Mm-hmm. That, you know, particularly when we look at something like the whole challenge of literacy, where, you know, the worrying thing I think about literacy is the fact that you've still got nearly 800 million people in the world today who don't have basic literacy skills. And that's what's worrying is that that figure really hasn't moved over the last 10 years. So, you know, it's clearly a massively challenging issue. And the only way that you really combat those big issues is if everyone comes together on it. So I think private sector has a big role to play, both as an alternative funding source to government, but also, you know, in the same way that we're thinking about this, I think that there's much more that we can bring to the table than just dollars, and that we have a lot to contribute in terms of intellectual capital, in terms of innovation, in terms of products and services. Mm-hmm. And equally, though, we don't have the experience or the expertise on the ground that either of my two, you know, fellow panelists have. And so there again, immediately, you start seeing the real opportunity for partnership. And, mm-hmm. you know, government sits centrally to this because so much when it comes to education is still delivered very much through state and will continue, and that will continue to be the case. So you need all three legs of the stool to get to really effective outcomes.
I none of you work in a context geographically, I think, where this applies, but I was really struck by a speech I heard Tony Blair give when he talked about there was a different, all education is not equal. Education that opens minds is very different than education that closes minds. Feel free to comment on that if you want to, but I just thought that was an interesting digression that has stuck with me. Michael, there's a question from the audience that is talking about the importance of literacy and confidence in reading being, and the fact that it's affected so much by the children's environments and their families. And I know your program is predominantly matching trained volunteers and one-on-one interventions to help children improve. Are there interventions either in your program or that happen parallel to your program that involve families?
Yeah, I'm glad that your audience is thinking about the context these children live in. And it's oftentimes a really sobering experience, even in the United States, to recognize the very human challenges that children have in public schools. And in high poverty communities, we're talking about making sure they've been fed. I had a principal tell me once the first thing he bought for his school when he took the job was a washing machine, because so many of his kids came to school and hadn't washed their clothes in days. So kids are messy human beings who come into school buildings, and we have this learning agenda for them, and understanding that whole complex world that's outside the school building is absolutely critical. And the research is incredibly compelling that students who come from monolingual households or pre-literate households are far more likely to be struggle with literacy themselves. I think at Reading Partners, we've focused on working within, and I take Kate's point very much to heart, working within the context of the public school system, because we have universal access in the United States, and it's a way to easily work directly with students to drive learning achievement. We have tremendous challenges and trust issues between families and public schools in the United States that affect different demographics in different ways. In the newcomer populations, it's oftentimes a mistrust of government because of immigration issues. In the African-American communities, you oftentimes see multi-generational poverty. I talked with a mom in Ward 8 in Washington, D.C., which is the poorest part of the city, who told me that she and her mom had gone to the same school that her daughter was now failing at. And so that school had let down three generations of that family. And so I think it's hard. It's hard to get families in the building, and it's hard to rebuild that trust. And so the approach we've taken is first to work directly with students, and then because we're kind of neither fish nor fowl, we're there in the school, but we're not a part of the school, to use that as a way to extend an invitation to those families to come back in. And we do that by hosting regular events at the school where we celebrate the accomplishments students are making in reading, and we help parents with strategies that they can use at home to support early reading, even if they are monolingual or pre-literate themselves. It's hard. And by the way, that mistrust, like I said, is well-founded not just in the sometimes legacy between those schools and those families, but also and I say this with many, many friends that are professional educators, I think sometimes the world of professional education in the United States is dismissive of the role that families can play and thinks very highly of its sort of training expertise and data and systems and doesn't often enough view families as part of that equation. And I think we need to really raise the bar in how we view those families as partners in education and to think of education reform as not something that happens to families but with families.
Mm-hmm. In your girls program, Erin, do you touch on involving families or mentors in some way?
Both in the literacy and the work. I mean, the number one determinant of whether a child grows up literate is if there is a literate mother in the household. And that's actually probably true globally. I know that at least for certain in all the work that we do internationally. And so I think that, the reality is, education absolutely starts at home, and it is, you have to have that connection. I think in our work, what we see really powerful is, again, I said most of the families are illiterate, but we still hold literacy events in the community. We still invite the parents in, and we actually have parent conferences, not just in our girls' education program, where there are actually a requirement, for the program, but even in our literacy work, where we just talk to the parents about, placing a priority on education. Even if you are not literate yourself, you can ask your child, what did you learn at school today? You can create a corner in your family small home to say, this is where you're going to study. I want to encourage you to study. You can, have a child check out a book and come home and read to you or read to your siblings. There are many, many ways in which you can encourage and celebrate and focus on education. And that is all the reason why a child will be successful. When they are rewarded and they see it as a family, you know, initiative and focus, that is where, you know, the encouragement is so strong.
I want to just
say, I think Michael touched on it as well, though, about the fact that I think the challenge, of course, is that so many of these parents that we're looking at where they are illiterate have so many other issues going on. And when you're living in extreme poverty and you're trying to take down two or three jobs, the amount of time you've got to spend supporting your kids. So how do we support those parents through toolkits, materials? We've got a great partnership that MBC have really driven on providing a parent toolkit, somewhere where you can go online. You've got to make it as easy and as accessible as possible. And I think it's also, I mean, we look at it from a global perspective and we think about it from the emerging markets, but exactly as Michael's saying, in the US and equally in London, you know, I think about one of the wealthiest cities in the world, think about the UK, you know, in our poorest wards, we're seeing 40% of adults don't have the basic literacy skills you'd expect to see in an 11-year-old. Mm. So it's an issue that's really on our doorstep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that it's something that we've got to put more focus and attention on.
You have to model the behavior you
want
to see.
Exactly.
You know, that's how you create readers.
Well, and I think when I think about the broken promise that Michael talked about in terms of three generations in the international context, when a subsistence farmer is giving up shoes maybe for another child to send his child to school to pay for it. And with the promise that the next generation will do better and the next generation doesn't do better, then we're breaking our promise all the way around. Kate, you touched, I know that 21st century, I've heard you speak about 21st century skills. Do you want to touch on that a bit? I know we talked a little bit about it in the context of defining literacy. But I also saw that we have in our audience the founder of World Reader, which is using tablets to facilitate reading internationally. So it would be inappropriate not to at least touch on the technological aspect of reading and what some of the opportunities and skills are that are important in that area.
Yeah, I think we should have a contribution from the audience at this point. I think you're touching on two issues there. So in terms of the 21st century skills piece, I mean, you know, the challenge is that, you know, in another two decades, you're going to have half the jobs that we have today are going to become automated. So the skills that the kids who are growing up today are going to need are really different from the ones that probably, that, you know, I definitely needed to be, you know, to be successful. And so I think we have to start thinking about literacy in a very different way. And that was the point I was making earlier about why something like the ability to code is going to become as important as the ability to read. Mm-hmm. But then I think you were touching on, you know, where absolutely World Reader at the forefront on this one is about the whole digital opportunity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot is talked about internet and the internet being the great leveler and everyone having access. But the reality is that, you know, only 40% of the world has access to the internet. And as soon as you start going into many of the markets that Erin's working in, you know, it drops substantially. But mobile is huge, you know, and you think about, so, I mean, in across all economic divides, you know, people have access to mobile. And I think that, you know, there are some really smart, increasingly smart innovations which give, you know, people who wouldn't otherwise have had access to books, that opportunity through mobile to be able to read in a way that just wouldn't have been possible. Mm-hmm. So I think particularly the mobile opportunity is really exciting. But you've got somebody much more qualified in the audience to talk about this than me.
Well, I think you get validated because I Abed, the founder of BRAC, told me that he thought that when mobile phones got to $50 or smartphones got to $50, that then it could really be used for education. And given the pace of technology, that's not probably that far away. Is things like Khan Academy going to help you do your job, Michael?
Yeah, I think technology is really an exciting lever for us to help kids improve their reading. And building off your comment, Kate, about mobile devices, there was a terrific piece of research that came out just a few months ago that found that even without smartphones, even something as simple as text messages being sent to the parents of preschoolers encouraging them to read with kids had a demonstrable effect on their school readiness and their reading achievement. So So sometimes it actually is, doesn't require that much, you know, gee whiz technology. It's actually very simple things, and simply using technology as a conduit to communicate these things we know work for kids can be tremendously successful. At the same time, I think, too, there is a fundamentally human aspect of reading. And it is part of why it's such a powerful skill. It's not just about your ability to access text and understand your world, but it's about broadening your world and understanding yourself in a global context. And the time kids spend reading with their parents or reading with a caring adult, again, is shown to benefit them not just academically, but socio-emotionally. And there's been also some incredibly exciting research in the last several years about the connection between what we call non-cognitive skills or grit and student success later in life, and finding that that's almost as important. And so while I'm a big fan of Khan Academy, and I think there are great ways that technology can reinforce the cognitive aspects of reading, I think that human component, that idea of a kid, you know, opening up and discovering Narnia is so important. And I think we can never lose that. And so I view technology as a tool that we can use to make that human interaction more powerful for kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing now is I think there's this conversation happening as if technology and education or teachers and schools and technology are like at odds, right? And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I mean, technology is a means to an end, right? It's a platform, and you know, we're agnostic to how it happens in some ways, right? But you still need people who understand how to invent and create great content and the platforms themselves. And you still need the connection to what is this for? What is the, you know, what critical skills are you developing, you know, however you access those? And I think the neat thing about technology is it can actually be used to bring efficiency and effectiveness in really interesting ways. Ways that you're just talking about in terms of measurement and things that we've talked about. There's a lot of ways that technology can be used to understand when is education being successful or not, and how do you challenge that to be, you know, to have more access. All sorts of ways that you can use it to really complement what teachers and schools and parents are doing. And I think that's where we should be finding those ways to think about it, you know, being a more accessible, more efficient way of delivering education.
So, Aaron, since you're speaking, we have a question from the audience about what is the reaction in a developing world context when a international, especially U.S. Western-based nonprofit comes in, and how do you manage local ownership and acceptance?
So I will say that one of the key challenges, or one of the key benefits of Rundreads model, is that we are actually working in countries that really do invite us in. We're not working in countries under conflict or with, you know, other challenges that may make it more difficult for a nonprofit to come in. We are actually most successful in countries that are committed to education but don't have the resources or potentially or the know-how to be successful. And so our partnerships, because first and foremost, we are invited in by the government and we're working in collaboration with them and we're helping them to be more successful in something that they've identified is an educational initiative that they care about, we generally have really collaborative relationships. I think the harder challenges is in politically unstable countries or, you know, where there are, you know, much almost more Maslow's hierarchy level one needs around safety and basic needs that are not being met. Those are probably not necessarily the areas where education can be the solution. And so those are oftentimes where, you know, international development agencies can perhaps be more at odds with the governments. So for the most part, we're if anything, trying to not do the government's job for them. We have to be careful that what our role is we're setting parameters around that we are there to help build skills and help build capacity, but do not want to take on the job of the government either. And so we actually are trying to make sure that we're not doing too much work and overtaking some of the schools that we're in, because we really want to institutionalize the program so the government can scale and deliver Room to Read-like services, you know, without Room to Read involved.
There was another question about international missionary or religious-based organizations using that either as a catalyst for providing education or a reward for conversion. Are you witnessing that, and does that create any challenges in terms of acceptance? And
I mean, there are, you know, I without this is not an issue that I think is easy to talk about in generalities. I mean, I think there are many organizations that do good work that are faith-based and do not necessarily evangelize. There are other cases, and there are plenty of them, and that, you know, where the lines are blurred. So it is a complex, you know, part of civil society that is very much connected, you know, in terms of faith-based organizations. But there, I think from our perspective, you know, there are really good motivations that many of the organizations have that are not profitizing, and they are delivering great services. And so it's not one, you can't paint, you know, the brush and call everyone good or bad. I think mm-hmm. you have to really dig in and understand how do they deliver the model, what is their community relationships, you know, and make choices, you know, organization by organization.
And I would just add, Kim, that those lessons of respect for communities are as important domestically as they are internationally. Yeah. I wrote a piece in Nonprofit Quarterly a few months ago that kind of grappled with this question. I asked, are we Walmartizing the social sector? And as organizations like Reading Partners and Teach for America grow up and scale and replicate into more and more cities, are we being respectful of the ecosystem of organizations that are there? And how are we thinking about the, you know, entrance of an outsider into highly impoverished communities? And there are cultural politics inside the United States. We launched in Oklahoma last year, being a guy from California talking to people in Oklahoma. Sometimes that's a political statement. And so I think it's as important that organizations that are thinking about scale or thinking about how to impact kids domestically are also attuned to these issues of sort of respectfulness and acknowledgement of what's already there in communities before you start to do something.
I think it sounds, it means it just takes longer. So this week we've just launched a partnership with Save the Children, which is putting education solutions into the refugee camps and for the Syrian refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon. You know, again, really sensitive areas to be working. I think Save the Children has amazing credibility in this space. So whilst it may well be perceived as a Western NGO, I think it's also, you know, got such a great track record that a lot of credibility. But even then, you know, we would have liked to have had this partnership up and running 12 months ago, 15 months ago, and you've just got to go at the right pace. So exactly to the point that you've got the government and the local community on board and engaged, so you set yourself up for success in the long run, which doesn't mean, I think, that you should get put off. Right. I think it just means that you manage it really carefully, and I'm completely with you, you know, and I think particularly from Gates' experience on this one, you know, I think having local partners on the ground makes such a difference in terms of local communities' willingness to engage and work with you.
The idea that I just lost my train of thought. Local partners. What was it? What did you say right before that? You were talking about
talking about the time.
I was talking about refugee camps.
Yeah.
So I actually wanted to compliment Pearson on that partnership, because the children's stay, the average stay in refugee camps is 15 years. And most of the children that are out of school are displaced populations or in camps. And the irony is that in a camp, they're a captive audience, so it ought to make delivering education easy. But the challenge is, we go back to Aaron's point about hierarchy of needs, safety, health, food, water, shelter, all come first, and there's a limitation on aid. So I want to commend you for looking at that population, because I think it really needs to be looked at.
I think Save the Children have been really good partners with us on this one, and have really helped, I think, guide our thinking about the approach. And I think, you know, something like when you have humanitarian crises, like we have obviously at the moment in Syria, I think, you know, for corporates particularly, always, because you often have employee bases who rightly want to be in there and be seen to be helping and doing something, that the, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is to go in there straight away. Whereas actually, if I think of it from our perspective, the real value add that we can bring is not when the media are all focused on it. It's exactly to your point that kids are spending, it's whole generations growing up in refugee camps. Mm-hmm. And so our value add is much more when you're trying to rebuild communities and you're basically trying to save a generation from coming through with no education, which, you know, probably is much less in a way, particularly we're getting a lot of great recognition from our employees, but, you know, I think it's when you see the headlines, when employees are usually putting the pressure on saying, what are you guys doing about this? Whereas the real value add, I think, is this longer term, probably less glamorous, but much more value add approach.
Absolutely. And I think staying the course on the part of funders is really, really important. I have a question here about strategies, and it sounds like it's more domestically focused than international, but it's talking about Arabic girls and the challenges when there's a family culture that that believes that they're safer when they're not educated and they're at home than when they're educated. And how do you break through some of those cultural barriers, whether they're domestic or international? Who wants to try and tackle that?
I can jump in. Okay. I think, you know, it's interesting, in the United States, we have not only universal access, but you know, schooling is compulsory. And so there's one level at which it's easy to get kids in the building, but there are tremendous cultural biases across many cultures that come into our public schools that do create challenges. Interestingly, there are, so the population that many of us focus on are students coming from monolingual Spanish households here in California in particular. And in Spanish, there are different words for teaching that describe different kinds of activity. So enseñar and educar mean different ideas about what parents' responsibilities are and what schools' responsibilities are. And bridging that cultural gap and getting to the idea that both parties have to do both things is an incredibly important thing for schools to do. And it requires cultural competency. It requires a recognition of that cultural barrier, a willingness of the school to engage and to not, as I said earlier, sort of push families away, but instead to bring them closer. And I think in overcoming those obstacles, you can, in the case of the United States, it's not an issue of getting them in the building, it's more an issue of making education a household value and something that's celebrated and viewed as a priority and that families are a part of. So I think it's all about understanding the culture, being respectful, and bringing it close.
Take an example, which isn't an education one, but I think of the work that Rajiv Gandhi is doing in Uttar Pradesh with women's networks. And I think that has an amazing impact when women are able to connect. So when you can suddenly give women, you know, that, because I think one of the big challenges you've got is women are very isolated. And I think when they have that opportunity to be able to start to connect with other women in their community, and the way that that happens is through women themselves breaking down those barriers and forming those networks, you start to see an amazing impact, whether it's in terms of, you know, in the example of sort of the work that Rajiv Gandhi and they've been looking at, it's been much more about from, you know, agricultural planning to how women come together in terms of healthcare access, how they help each other from that perspective. But it's all back to, you know, the point Erin made at the beginning of the conversation, it's all about confidence and it's all about feeling empowered and feeling supported. And suddenly then, with that comes a degree of bravery that makes a real difference. And then you start to see movement, and then you start to see things breaking through and women getting out of the house and kids getting out of the house and being able to actually get access to education.
So we have another question that's sort of related to that from the audience. And then, Kate, I'm going to give you a heads up. You're going to be our wrap-up question on...
I've seen it with Erin.
They're like three-part
okay.
questions.
Yeah, exactly.
I may not give you a twist. You're going to talk about trends at the very end. But Erin, if you could quickly address how you deal with second language issues, and especially in an environment where maybe the national or the business language is English or French, and the family language is something else. So how do you deal with that in an international context?
I mean, it is very complex. Mother tongue issues are probably part of the most complex issues in a lot of the countries that we're working in. And to be honest, because we are working in the government systems and in a lot of the countries that we are working, there is a national language of instruction. Our program is designed to work in the government school system, and so we are, you know, first and foremost, designing our work within that national language. There are oftentimes opportunities we can have, in you know, particularly in grade one, and how do you use storyboarding and kind of language exercises to bring children with maybe speaking a different mother tongue, you know, into the classroom. But our main work is in the language of instruction. The interesting part is in some of the countries we're in, there's big debates on when do you switch then to something like English. As the second language. And so what do you do that in fifth grade, fourth grade, third grade? You know, how much do you push that if you want to be, you know, quote unquote, more employable if you have, you know, a global language like that? And I think that, you know, a lot of the data has proven that don't do that too soon. You know, children learn best and can become strong readers and have a solid foundation, you know, in the national language first, and, you know, can learn better than and faster actually in a second language further out. But you don't want to do that too early either, and they may not have developed a solid enough foundation. But there's, it's a complex issue, and it's not one that's going to be, you know, easily solved anytime soon, because in many of the languages, you know, South Africa has 11 national languages, right? So it's a complex issue for many governments, and it just compounds the cost of delivering education and materials, books, et cetera.
And Michael, I'm sure that you have something to say about languages domestically that we would love to hear, but I think since I promised Kate the wrap-up question on trends, you're going to get it because we're running out of time. So Kate, what are the global trends that you want to touch on or share with us?
So I think, you know, I think there's a huge amount to be optimistic about. And I think you only have to look at the work that you guys are doing and you see real progress being made. But at the same, you know, I come back to that, you know, what I think is the killer stat is the fact that you've still got 791 million people without basic literacy skills, and that that number hasn't moved really in the last 10 years, and that two-thirds of those are women. You know, so that's the challenge. I think that there is a phenomenal amount of interest. I think there's some really great work happening, but that's what we've got to focus on.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank our panelists. This concludes our program for this evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Aaron Ganjut, Kate James, and Michael Lombardo for an excellent discussion. Many thanks as well to you, the audience, for your terrific questions, and good night.